welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Well, in the second hour of today's show, I have a very distinguished guest. And we're going to be talking about some questions related to international law, to the prosecution of very high-level criminals in international law. And this is a subject I've actually discussed in previous shows. But I have tonight on the show, I have Professor Francis Boyle from the University of Illinois, who was actually part of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. And this was actually a very little known event that took place a couple of years ago in Malaysia. It was a very important event and a very important trial that indicted high-level people of the US government in war crimes. Now, of course, in countries like Australia, these types of judicial proceedings are not given much coverage on the news. I don't think it was covered at all on our news. I know it was covered on RT and a few other alternative media organisations, but our media, which is part of the globally controlled media cartels of the world, tend to just ignore this. And, of course, our own political leaders tend to scoff at these types of proceedings and regard them as being of no importance. But I do believe that they are of extreme importance, and that a time will come when the findings of these commissions will actually be seen to have a legal weight around the world. So, and we're also going to be talking about NGOs and the infiltration of NGOs by those who are pushing US foreign policy. Another very, very interesting and very disturbing topic, and one that relates to the ongoing crisis in the Ukraine. So, without further ado, let me welcome Professor Francis Boyle to the show. Are you there, Professor Boyle?
I am. Thank you very much for having me on, and my best to your listening audience, and good day.
Absolutely. Look, thank you so much for making the time to come on today. I'd like to start with a look at your work with the War Crimes Tribunal in Malaysia. And I have to say, I wasn't fully aware of it. And this is I think this is testament to the problems we have in the media today of the lack or the control in which media and the control of information that takes place in the media. It is incredible that such an important proceeding as you were involved in is not more widely known. Wouldn't you say that, just to start off with?
Well, it doesn't really surprise me. The mainstream news media, certainly here in the United States, is pretty much in the pocket of the government, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. It doesn't really matter. And now, I take it Australia is probably not much different from here in America. No better, no worse, no different. So, sure, that was not covered here in the United States, and pretty much censored out of mainstream news media everywhere.
Absolutely. So can you give us a bit of the background of the tribunal? How did it form, and why did it form in Malaysia? What were the forces behind it that brought it into being?
Well, it was really the Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, the retired prime minister, as he was leaving office, decided to, you know, move on with the next stage of his life and his career. So he had a big international conference, and, you know, he wanted to do something, make a contribution. So I went out to speak, and then I was asked to be part of a drafting committee, and we came up with a document called the Kuala Lumpur Declaration to Criminalize War. And I helped draft that. There was a team, and, you know, my argument to Dr. Mahathir was that war was already illegal under the Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact of 1928 and the United Nations Charter. So the next stage would be to criminalize that. So that was acceptable to him and the other members of the drafting team. And this then led to the establishment of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. And to make a long story short, I was prosecutor there, and we had started out with two different prosecutions. The first was against Bush Jr. and Tony Blair for committing a Nuremberg crime against peace for their invasion of Iraq. And there were, you know, very extensive investigations. There was an indictment. They were served. There was the prosecution. I was one of two lead prosecutors. There was a tribunal, proceedings, and at the end of the day, they were both convicted for Nuremberg crimes against peace, which is, you know, not on the same scale of what the Nazis did in Europe.
Yeah.
But the same crime.
Yeah, the same, basically the same principle. Sorry, continue. Yeah.
Right, right. The same principle, certainly not the same scale. So then from there, we moved on to deal with the entire torture scandal in the United States, which, as you know, regretfully, President Obama has refused to deal with, despite the fact that the torture convention requires the Bush officials involved in the torture scandal to be prosecuted. So we decided to move into that vacuum and organized another set of proceedings. Again, there's nothing quick about this. First, there's an investigation by a war crimes staff. They assemble all the facts. Then they present the case to a war crimes commission of experts. Then the commission decides if they want to return an indictment, and then the indictment is prosecuted before the tribunal. So again, I was prosecutor there, and the indictment was returned against Bush Jr., Cheney, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, the lawyer, Gonzalez, Condoleezza Rice, Tenet, the CIA director, and these other prostituted lawyers working for Bush that basically said this wasn't torture. So again, very extensive hearings, trial, and at the end of the day, they were convicted of torture and war crimes. When torture occurs during wartime, that is also a violation of the Geneva Conventions and a war crime. And when torture is widespread or systematic, which I argue both was the case here,
yeah,
it is also a crime against humanity. So they were convicted of those charges. And, you know, we move on from there. I've tried to get Bush in Geneva, scared him out of Geneva when a demand was made that he be prosecuted for torture if he showed up in Geneva. We did try to get Bush in Canada, I think three times. We've tried to get Cheney twice. So right now, there are large numbers of lawyers all over the world, and we have a dossier on Bush, Cheney, and the rest of these people. And in the event they travel outside of the United States, efforts will be made to present the dossier to get them to be detained, and then to initiate criminal proceedings against them. Obviously, it's pretty much like what happened to General Pinochet in London. So this is going to take time. The you know, these major international war criminals and war crimes, it's not going to happen tomorrow. But I'm confident there are just so many lawyers out there and some good NGOs working on this, like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union here in the United States, and there are some European, you know, NGOs of lawyers working on this that, at the end of the day, I think we'll get one or more of them.
Absolutely.
In any event, they now have to consult with their lawyers about where they can travel. And in the meantime, we're going to try to take steps to get them prosecuted here in the United States as well. But regretfully, it doesn't appear President Obama is going to do that.
Can I ask, what is the level of recognition of the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal internationally? And is there a process by which that becomes recognized in a country? What's the actual legal process by which the findings of this commission are brought to the attention of other countries?
Oh, well, first, the commission was set up under Malaysian law.
Right.
So it does have a legal status there in Malaysia. And then they have a very big organization over there that has, you know, I'm not in charge of administrative details or fundraising or things of that nature, organizational matters, that brings the convictions to the attention of states around the world. And also to the International Criminal Court. I myself, separate from this, filed a complaint against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Tenet, and Rice for their policy of extraordinary renditions, which is really a euphemism for the enforced disappearance of human beings and their consequent torture.
Yeah.
Now, the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute. However, these international crimes were committed in Rome Statute states, and therefore the ICC does have jurisdiction. So I filed that complaint, and it's still pending there at the ICC. I keep up on it. We'll see what happens with that. But I think I was the first person ever to surmount the jurisdictional hurdle because every complaint before mine had just been summarily rejected on the grounds that the United States was not a party to the Rome Statute. And that complaint then was the one at stake in Switzerland, where a Swiss parliamentarian demanded that Bush be arrested under their domestic implementing legislation for the Rome Statute. If you become a Rome Statute state, I think Australia is,
yes.
You are then required to adopt domestic implementing legislation making the ICC crimes domestic crimes.
Professor Ball, we're just going to break. Sorry to interrupt. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're going to break, talking about International War Crimes Tribunal from Malaysia. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm talking to my guest today, Professor Francis Boyle, Professor of International Law at University of Illinois in the United States. And we've been talking about the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal and the proceedings that Professor Boyle took part in. and the way it was received and the responses, which seem to have been quite significant in that it has actually had some effect on the behaviour of those indicted individuals. I've just got another question for you, Professor Boyle, about the kind of the constitution of this tribunal. Does it mirror the International Criminal Court? I mean, can you say that the procedures and legal processes that took place in that are the same as the International Criminal Court, or is it somehow different? Is it affected by Malaysian law? I know, of course, Malaysia is a country that observes some aspects of Sharia law, which we regard as being invalid in Australia, and there has been a lot of publicity about certain prosecutions in Malaysia which have been considered to be not well-grounded in law. And I'm just curious about that aspect of it, and can you vouch for the solidity of the way in which these legal proceedings were taken place in Malaysia?
Yes, there's an entire charter for the War Crimes Tribunal. I did not draft it, but one of Malaysia's top international law professors drafted it. And it patterns itself on the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. And it's just solidly grounded in international criminal law. There's nothing about Sharia law in there, and certainly in the proceedings I participated in, we just argued straight out international criminal law, human rights law, international law. To be sure, Malaysia is a Muslim country, but, yes. You know, in the proceedings I was involved in, that didn't come up. That's why they retained me as a prosecutor, because I'm an expert on international law, human rights, laws of war, things of that nature, and certainly not Sharia law. So,
and that's very important, because that means that the findings, the conclusions, that these could easily be transferred to the context of the International Criminal Court, and you followed all those due processes. Does the International Criminal Court have a position on the findings of the Malaysian Tribunal, or is that, I'm not quite sure how these kind of institutions would communicate with each other? Do they recognise each other? Is there any form of communication there that takes place?
Well, all the proceedings were transmitted to the International Criminal Court.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, you know, I can't control the ICC, what they do or they don't do. So it's sitting there, and we'll have to see what, if anything, they do with it. I just don't know. But whether they act or they don't, as I said, I can act in my own capacity as a professor of international law. And we have other lawyers around the world who will continue to act as well. When we have a target of opportunity, when one of these individuals travels outside of the United States and we have prior knowledge of that, we have dossiers that, you know, we can immediately file against them. Of course, that would be up to the, you know, the prosecuting authorities in different countries. And regretfully, so far, Belgium, Spain, Germany have all been somewhat reluctant to go after high-level U.S. government officials, not on the merits, but basically for political reasons. But I thought we had a good shot there in Switzerland, because the prosecuting authorities there are pretty independent of the government. And I think that's why Bush didn't show up, because I think he realized that the prosecutors would have gone forward. I can't say, but I take it his lawyers told him not to show up. This is a problem we had in Canada, that the Harper government was very close to the Bush administration, and they repeatedly aborted our proceedings against Bush and Cheney. As I said, three times, I think, against Bush, twice against Cheney. But Harper won't be there forever.
Absolutely.
So this is not, you know, this is not anything easy or is going to happen tomorrow. But again, large numbers of lawyers all over the world working on this. The documentation is there. And I think eventually, you know, we'll see Bush or Cheney pretty much like General Pinochet or Yugoslav President Milosevic. I'm the attorney of record for the mothers of Srebrenica and Podrina, the women who survived that massacre at Srebrenica, and I convinced the ICTY prosecutor for the Carlo Del Ponte of the International Criminal Tribunal to indict Milosevic for every crime in the ICTY statute book, including two counts of genocide, one for Bosnia in general and the second for Srebrenica in particular. And she indicted him, and he was on trial in The Hague, and the prosecution's case closed. He filed a motion to dismiss all charges. That was denied by the ICTY panel, the judges. And then the defense case was about to open when Milosevic died. So that was that. So I was greatly looking forward to Milosevic presenting his case to find out the involvement of the so-called internationals who supported Milosevic, like Holbrook and David Owen and many others. But we never got to hear that. So there you go. Right now, General Mladic is in a similar situation. He's about to present his defense. I'm not involved in his prosecution, but I am following it to see if further evidence develops in his defense that can be used against these internationals. Kofi Annan, a whole list of them who were complicit in the massacre at Srebrenica. So, yes, the tools of the wheels of international justice turn slowly, but they do turn. As I told the mothers of Srebrenica when I first met with them in Bosnia, I said, look at the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, going back to the atrocities committed by the Argentinian junta in the 1970s. They got themselves organized, pressure, et cetera, et cetera. And 30 years later, prosecutions began in Argentina and are going on now as we speak. So now, you know, now they're the, they call themselves the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. But we are seeing justice being administered now.
That's
in Argentina by Argentinian courts.
It's great to feel some optimism, and I think you're expressing a position of some optimism in what otherwise seems like a very bleak situation at the moment, where we see those most powerful countries seeming to get away scot-free for so long. But the wheels of justice do turn, and I think you're right. I think there is an inexorable force moving towards to justice and reconciliation, and to the truth coming out, as Shakespeare said, you know, murder will out in the end.
And well, I think that's right, but people have an unrealistic expectation of the time frame here. If you look at it historically.
Absolutely. Sorry to cut you off. We're just going to break. We're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're going to break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm talking to Professor of International Law, Dr. Francis Boyle, about the inexorable wheels of justice that are turning around the world to bring perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against peace and torture to justice. And you were saying, Professor Boyle, that justice does come, but it doesn't come as quickly as a lot of people want, and then they feel they feel frustrated by that. You were cut off at the end of the last break there.
Well, I think that's right. I think people who are not lawyers do feel frustrated about the process, that it takes so long. I remember I went after Milosevic the first time in the International Court of Justice in The Hague when I was Bosnia's lawyer arguing the genocide case against him. And that was 1993, and that the genocide in Bosnia was being supervised by Milosevic in Belgrade and not by Karadzic in Pale. And by the way, Karadzic is on trial, too. And at that time, it looked like the Bosnians were about to get wiped out. Hmm. And I just decided, okay, I'm going to establish a record, a predicate here against Milosevic. Well, what happened was, in reaction to the order I won from the World Court on 8 April 1993, the United Nations Security Council decided to set up the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And then I continued my efforts after Milosevic, and then in 2000 met with Carla Del Ponte with my clients, and it took me a year. I had to get her out to Bosnia too to see the situation firsthand and meet with the victims. But within a year after I met her, then she indicted Milosevic. So we're already talking 8 years there. So these things, and Milosevic certainly did not have the power that Bush and Blair had. Look at Tony Blair. He's completely shameless that he's running all over the world. I don't know if he's been out to Australia recently, and no one has apprehended him and prosecuted him for the crimes that he clearly committed in Iraq.
Well, can I just add
enormous sums of money?
Can I just add to that, Professor Boyle? Our own Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, is equally culpable because the Australian involvement in the Coalition of the Willing, as they called it, was extremely important at the time. Even though it was a very, very token contribution, the fact that another nation state at the other end of the world actively joined this Coalition of the Willing was very significant from a propaganda viewpoint. Have you had a look at John Howard at all?
I had a look, and I've had some Australian lawyers and human rights activists send me those materials. That's correct. And yes, his role in Iraq was notorious and well known. But I have to leave that to the Australian lawyers to deal with him. That was my response. I know you have some very fine human rights lawyers and international lawyers out there, but I think the answer is the same. Not on the scale of Tony Blair and George Bush, who were the major architects of that war against Iraq, but he had his role to play, and he certainly needs to be held accountable out there in Australia. And especially when Australia is a party to the Rome Statute, to the International Criminal Court, I think a complaint could be filed there. And then, in addition, the Australian lawyers need to take a look at your domestic implementing legislation for the Rome Statute to the International Criminal Court, and see if a case can be made against him in the Australian courts.
Yes, I believe there have been some filings made against John Howard, and it was done a few years ago. I haven't heard much about it. It did pop up in the news very briefly and then disappeared again and hasn't been mentioned again. It's probably just another one of these things that's going on under the surface there. It's probably happening, but we're not getting informed about it. Again, we have a big problem with the media, don't we? It's like we're not informed about what's going on, which contributes to the stagnation and the kind of the tendency towards more tyrannical behavior on the parts of governments. The media has an incredible role to play in facilitating that, don't they?
Well, that's correct. And fortunately, these days we do have the internet, so that certainly those of us who are lawyers around the world stay in touch with each other. I'm on several lists, and I have, you know, I have a whole stable of human rights lawyers I work with around the world. So, you know, we know what we're doing, and we stay in touch with each other, and we swap notes and things of that nature. But you are correct, getting it into the mainstream news media anywhere is extremely hard because, you know, the mainstream news media, they don't want to take on people in power either. Their owners and operators are part of these people in power. So they're part of the power structure in all of these countries. And, you know, even if they agree with us, as they see it, it's bad for business. Certainly here in the United States, all television stations and radio stations have to get operating licenses from the United States federal government. And they don't want those operating licenses to be threatened. That is not the case for print media. They have a First Amendment protection here in the United States. But with the interconnections between print media and televised media, you're not talking about too many of them that are independent of the government. Yeah. So it's a constant problem, but, you know, we now have alternative media sources. You know, certainly when I started as a law professor here in 1978 doing that work, we didn't have that. It just wasn't there. So now we do have it, and that activists in good faith can, you know, turn to the Internet. You know, if you hit the Internet, you can find on YouTube, all about the proceedings of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. They have a web page. So you can inform yourself, but you are correct. You're not going to get it out of the mainstream news media. And that's why I'm spending 40 minutes today talking with you.
Indeed.
Because you're interested in this matter, and I know you're going to do your best to get the message out. And I think this is a very important endeavor on your part. So here I am.
Absolutely. And I have to say, you know, the Malaysian government has done a lot to advance some very important questions about truth and justice, because I know that Malaysia hosted a number of conferences investigating aspects of 9/11 that were quite unique. And again, Malaysia really stands out in that way, and I do really you know, applaud them for doing something that that hasn't been done in virtually any other country. Certainly, any other country, English speaking country or country with a kind of a Western or British background, we simply hang on the coattails of U.S. foreign policy. Now.
That's unfortunate. You know, Australia is now going on with this Obama's pivot towards China. It's against China.
And, absolutely.
This is extremely dangerous. It could involve Australia in a war against China.
Absolutely.
Because that's clearly where Obama's pivot is going. A war could break out tomorrow over those islands.
And
which,
sadly, Professor...
Obama was just out there promising Japan we would defend them, when in fact Japan stole them from China in 1895.
Absolutely. We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Sure. Sorry to interrupt. We'll be right back after this break. Very important interview. Please stay with us. Welcome back, you with Truth News Radio. It's great to be with you today. My guest today is Dr. Francis Boyle, and we are talking about some very, very important issues about bringing truth and justice, bringing true justice, not the sham justice that we constantly see kind of trumpeted by the media and trumpeted by governments as they engage in their basically wars of conquest. Now, you made some very important points there in the previous segment, Professor, in regard to Australia's position. We are in a very, very vulnerable position because having allied ourselves with US foreign policy, we actually have no allies in our region anymore. And we have put ourselves at odds with our nearest neighbour, Indonesia, because of our very, very bizarre refugee policies, which the Indonesians just scratch their heads at and can't even figure out because it's very illogical. We take refugees, but then we move them to other islands. We take boats, we take refugees off boats and put them on other boats and send the boats back to Indonesia, all at our own expense, but still sending the people back to Indonesia. And we have created a diplomatic standoff between ourselves and the region, and by falling in line with the United States, we really have created a scenario that could be very, very serious for us in the event that the whole thing comes to a head. And this is what I would like to just address before we get to the end of the show today, is that it does appear to be coming to a head. And the crisis, and part of it is the crisis of the need to find justice, the need for these war criminals and the torturers and all of the horrific policies that they have implemented, including those of the present administration, including drone strikes and all of this complete defiance of international law and order and civilization, is moving towards some kind of final crisis. And as we see, that is also tied to international geopolitical movement towards what looks like some great conflagration. And there were so many other things I wanted to talk to you about today, but can I just get you to briefly address where you think this is headed? And are these people who are running the show willing to lead us into a World War III scenario?
I'm afraid that's where it's going. I would like to alert the people in Australia, that's where things are going. You really need to read Sam Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. That's where Obama got his pivot towards Asia. And I went through the same PhD program at Harvard that produced Huntington before me. I refused to study with him because of his diehard support for the Vietnam War.
Yes.
If you read the book, at the very end, after attacking the oil states in the Middle East, Huntington then recommends that the United States pivot to Asia in order to confront China. And
wow.
The Huntington book ends with a war between the United States and China. And that is the way, that I think is the current policy by the Obama administration. That's clear the direction in which it is going. The situation with the Diu Islands is extremely volatile and dangerous. Everyone knows that those islands were stolen by Japan in the 1895 war of aggression against the Chinese Empire when they were weak and could not defend themselves. And after World War II, that those little pieces of rock were supposed to be given back to China.
Yeah.
And instead, the United States, for whatever reason, gave them to Japan. And it's a very serious flashpoint. Mm. You now have the air defense intercept zone by China, build up of forces there in both the South China, East China Sea. It's very dangerous, and as you know, I regret to say Australia has bought this pivot to against China, hook, yeah, line, and sinker. And you're now going to have the Marine Corps base there at Darwin,
yeah,
and more U.S. troops. You already have Pine Gap being used to spy on everyone, and indeed it appears the drone strikes, some of them are being orchestrated out of there. So I think people in Australia had better wake up. And certainly, if you want to read the end of Huntington's Clash of Civilization, where all this leads to a war between the United States and China that will drag in Australia, because, as you know, there is a mutual defense treaty between, yeah, the United States and Australia. Now, I could make a legal argument why that should not apply here, to that Australia is not obligated to support the United States in its aggressive maneuvers against China, in its defense of Japan's outrageous claims to the Diu Islands. But if shooting starts, I'm sure your government there is immediately going to try to get Australia on the side of the United States and Japan, which is pretty appalling. As you know, Australia fought, yeah, Japan in World War II. And to mobilize Australians once again to fight and die for a cause that is not their own. And let us recall what happened 100 years ago at Gallipoli, where, yeah, you know, young Australian men were basically used as cannon fodder by imperious British generals. Well, the yeah, same thing could happen here all over again with you know, young Australian men fighting and dying for Obama.
In an unwinnable situation. And one of the things that, you know, worries me is that, sure, there is this mutual defense agreement, but, you know, agreements can be varied and reneged on. And in the event that it got really bad, you know, how safe can we be? How sure can we be that the Americans wouldn't just say, well, actually, we're going to withdraw? You know, I mean, can we really rely on the Americans to be there to protect us? Or is it just a strategy that they're using for the time being? And then if the Americans suddenly did withdraw in the event that things got really hot, and the Americans decided in the event of other catastrophes that might unfold, including economic ones, that they were just going to protect the U.S. mainland, then there we are totally exposed, and we've now created enemies that see us possibly as a prize, this great continent with no one to defend it, and we've really set ourselves up to be demonized by them, and this is the worst case scenario. But, you know, a lot of people have talked about it, of Australia basically being taken over, lost, you know, invaded. The end of the Australia. It's already happened on some levels economically, certainly with the Chinese dominance economically, but even beyond that, the way we're headed looks like we're being set up almost as a sacrifice.
I think that's correct. You're being dragged along into this. If you read the ANZUS self-defense pact, it's what's known as a collective self-defense agreement concluded under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, and it would only be triggered in the event of an armed attack on the United States or Australia. Mm. So it would not be triggered in the event, and should not be triggered in the event, that there's a war there between Japan and China. Mm. And yet there's no way right now, the way it's currently configured, the political situation, that Australia will be able to stay out of that. They'll just get up there and lie to you and say, well, under our collective self-defense treaty, we, the Australians, have to come to the defense of the Americans and the Japanese against China. The other thing to keep in mind, the treaty is very crafty in the sense that the United States has always reserved its right not to come to the defense of Australia if it doesn't want to.
Oh, really?
Because the treaty says that any declaration of war must be approved by the United States Congress. So that really gives them the option either to defend you or not defend you. So I'm not exactly sure what Australia gets in return here. But in any event, you are clearly, in my opinion, from here in the United States, being set up for a fall. And I think you need to apply pressure to your political leaders to start to disengage from this pivot towards Asia.
From this kind of suicidal direction. And of course, that applies to the U.S. as well. There needs to be this internal dissent needs to move again to a higher level. And it sort of lost a lot of steam, didn't it, when Obama came in and that big anti-war movement kind of got defused. And yet the policies have continued, things have escalated, but the dissent needs to build, and there needs to be a point where some sort of is it going to be a civil war? Is it going to be a rebellion on the part, maybe perhaps, of some part of the U.S. military against what they're being forced to do? Any quick thoughts on that?
I really don't know exactly, what's going to happen. But I wrote a whole book on the outbreak of World War One, called "Foundations of World Order." And that's what it looks like to me today.
Yeah.
That we're moving in that direction. And unfortunately, the United States government is pushing in that direction, both in Asia against China and in Europe, Ukraine against Russia.
Thanks very much, Professor. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We're at the end of the hour. It's been superb having you on. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on, and my best to all my friends out there in Australia.
Thanks. I'd love to get you on again to talk about some of the other issues that we weren't able to cover. Thanks so much.
Sure. Bye.
And that's Truth News Australia for this week. We will be back next week. See you then.